Hey, Mañana Nomás visitors, thanks for coming back. I've got a new guest with us this week. I've got Joan Possavy. We met through a channel I haven't used that often. I actually reached out to find guests to be on the podcast. She was one of the recommendations. We had a quick conversation to make sure we'd be a good fit. And the great news for you is that she is better than a great fit. I believe she's going to be awesome. Her focus is on side hustles, and I'll let her give you some of the details. Joan, go ahead and introduce yourself to the audience, kind of what you do and what your passion and mission is.
Thank you so much, Kurt, and thanks for having me join you today. My passion is side hustles. I've been an entrepreneur most of my life. I did start out as a banker. Please don't hold that against me. But got the entrepreneurial bug at an early age. I was really fortunate when I was about 19 years old. I was invited to a seminar. Now, I had told it was going to be on business matters, predominantly marketing, because that's what I loved. But it turns out it wasn't about that at all. In fact, I remember that evening very clearly. There was about 300 of us in the room. I was seating about three rows back, two seats over, and I was mesmerized for like 2 hours because the speaker was talking about your mind and your potential. And I had never heard anything like that before. Up until that time, actually, all I'd studied is typical school subjects, science, history, math. I had never had anybody talk to me about my potential before. And here's this person at the front of the room going, it doesn't matter what's happened to you in the past. It doesn't matter perceived mistakes you've made, setbacks, horrible things that happened to you. That's all in the past. What do you want to do going forward? And he said, the truth is you can have, do, or be anything that you want in your life. And I'm like, whoa, that was a little bit shocking because up until that time, I thought that when you were born, you were dealt certain cards, so to speak, and those are the ones that you had to play. But I discovered, No, that's not true. You can throw back the cards that you don't like so much and grab new ones to prepare yourself to do what it is that you want to do. And so one of the goals I set early on as a result of, okay, let me backtrack a little bit. And so I was so intrigued by what I was learning, I have never stopped studying it. And that was more years ago than I want to count now. But diving down that big rabbit hole has allowed me to do fun things like buy my first house at the age of 19 and become branch manager of a financial institution at the age of 22, just from studying and applying these lessons. There's no magic to it. It can be taught by anyone. And that's actually how I ended up writing my book called The Way Success Works, is to put a lot of this in there. So fast forward a whole bunch of years, and for decades, I left banking, went into work for myself with businesses and entrepreneurial. My last business, now I've always straddled at least two worlds, one being the personal development space that I've just been describing. And then businesses on the side, partly because I love business, but also they provided me like a playing field to work with these ideas. I never wanted to be a speaker, just like talk about stuff. So when I started teaching passive income, it was like, oh, that's when I came across this idea of passive income businesses, which are businesses that require potentially a lot of work from you initially to start them up, but then the revenue from them is more passive. Think of owning a parking lot or an automated car wash or a laundromat. And for me, it was self-storage. And so I got involved in that industry and sold out, cashed out about 2 years ago. And then I was thinking, what do I want to do now? And I absolutely love, Kurt, hearing people's stories of how they got to where they were going, challenges that they overcome. I find them really inspiring. And so that's how one of the motivators for starting Side Hustle Hero, my podcast, is to bring people those stories to help them launch their own side hustles.
I find everything that you just said is bizarrely akin. And this was not pre-planned, folks. This is so 19. So I first saw, I believe it was Grant Cardone speak when I was 19. I was a car salesman. And very similar to yourself, was dealt a special set of cards and, you know, wasn't going to make it and wasn't going to have any options. And I guess I'm going to sell these cars. And then I went to a talk in Vegas and it was like, sleazy car salesman, just, you know, and I was new to the industry. Okay. And there was all these old dudes that smelled like cigarettes and poor suit jackets. And, you know, this is the 80s. Bourbon. Yeah, because I'm old, right? So this is the 80s. I'm in a casino that I'm underage in, right? I'm not supposed to even be in there. And this dude walks in yelling and screaming and hooting and hollering from the podium. And when someone looked like they were sleeping, he's winging tennis balls with $50 bills rubber banded to him, you know, and people freaking out. And right then and there, listening to him talk, I was like, why am I selling cars? I could be that. I could do that. Not a caricature of that, not the throwing the tennis balls and things. But I was like, there's so many different ways I could add value to people if I apply what I've learned in my short life already. Why am I doing this? And then it nagged me for a long time, but I went to business, to business, to business. And every business I went to, part of me was like, why am I a failure and unable to keep these jobs? And a lot of them I left voluntarily, but I just couldn't stand them. I just hated them. But I went from one job to another. So part of me was like, why am I failing at this? And then the other part of me was like, I am learning a ton of stuff about business. And it's amazing what that became by the time I was 35, 40 years old.
Okay.
But I'm listening to you and it's like, you were 19. Someone made an impression. It's like, okay, there's a lot of similarities there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, when someone comes to you with an idea for a startup, what gets you excited about it? Like, so is it the idea that it's a great idea, or is it the idea that someone wants to jump out of their comfort zone, or like, what is it that really gets you jazzed?
When I see the light bulb go on in somebody's mind, and you can see it in their expression, their enthusiasm changes, their voice tone, their body language, and they get excited about something.
Yeah.
And yeah. And then the next step, of course, is to take action on that. But there's so many side hustles out there. Like, I don't think that's the issue, is someone finding something that they can do. It's a matter of choosing. Like, if you Google, I don't know, top side hustles, you're going to get, you know, top 10 lists, top 100 lists. I think the first step really is to drill down on what would be a fit for you. Like you mentioned, all those jobs that you started and left, they weren't a fit. Although you were aware enough to see that there was some benefit you were learning along the way. And just as a little side note, I do a lot of work with like 19 to 30 year olds as well. I love that age demographic. And I say to them, you know, if you are in a job that for whatever reason you're not stoked about, you're not excited about, at some level you're choosing to be there. So while you are there, give it all you've got.
Yeah.
Because you never know what opportunities are going to arise. Like one tip from, I mentioned very young, I was a branch manager, the president of the company at the time, he gave me a bunch of good advice. In fact, I wrote, I think about two or three pages on what I called tips from Con. In my book. And one of them, he said to me, always be on the lookout for good staff, even if you don't need to hire them right away. So when you're in the drugstore or the gas station or whatever, think, that person is awesome. I'm going to come back and steal them if I ever have to hire. So back to my point about give it your best wherever you're at, you never know who's watching you and come back around with a business opportunity or business idea.
I echo that so much. People would say to me, why do you go? So when I was in the automotive industry and I ran service departments, I would hire people from the most unlikely of places. And peers in the industry would look at me and go, dude, what are you doing? They don't have their ASE certification. They don't have this. They don't have that. And I'm like, I went out for lunch and they gave me the best service I ever saw in my life.
Wow.
But I knew they didn't like working there. And I would just say, hey, you ever think about working on cars? Or you ever think about helping people with cars? You ever think about, and they would go, that would be awesome. And I go, you know what? I need you to come by the shop someday and talk to me, you know, and I'd hire them. I hired so many people from quick lube places. So here I was running an automotive service center. I could work on my truck for free. Right. But no, I'd take it down to Jiffy Lube and I would just look around and watch who's doing what. And then I'd go, that guy's got his act together. Nice. And then, you know, I'd say, hey, you know, how much do they pay you here? Oh, you know, you can make four times that, you know, working for me at the shop. Whoa. And I'll teach you everything you need to know. I'll teach you the tools. I'll teach you this. I'll put you together with a mentor. And then that's when I really began to understand what a mentor or an advisor could do for someone at the beginning stage.
Yes.
Powerful. Yeah. And so I'm real curious to where you go in that channel with folks.
Well, what you've really been talking about is that difference between hard skills and soft skills.
Yeah.
The hard skills you can teach. It's getting the certifications. It's doing the job. The soft skills is the stuff that you've been intrigued about, which is so much more difficult to teach. And I spent many, many years as a road warrior doing seminars, a lot on teams and management stuff. And at one particular seminar, I'd asked attendees, they were all managers. I said, think of one of your superstars in your employment and write down their top three characteristics. Like, why do you put them in that category of rock star, superstar?
Yeah.
And 99.9% of the stuff, when I asked them, okay, what did you write down? It's all the soft skill stuff. It's the attitude. It's the teamwork. It's the perception of your customers and colleagues. Of course, the hard skills training, the technical side is required, but you can train for all that. So it's like, give me somebody with a great attitude. I can teach them the other stuff, just like you were doing going to Jiffy Lube.
Yeah. Yeah. I got in so much heat. I used to run the training department at Suzuki, and I was looking for a graphics person to come in and help me make e-learning material. And I started interviewing, and I would go to HR and they would say, oh, well, no one met these skills or no one met that skill. So that's why we haven't referred anyone to you. I'm like, well, now I got to go find them myself. And I spoke to a woman named Michelle, and she listens to my podcast. So now she'll be happy because I mentioned Michelle was brilliant. Didn't know a dang thing about motorcycles, but man, she came in with like a portfolio. Like, this is some of the art that I've done. This is some of the things that I've done. I'm familiar with this software. I'm familiar with this. I can do this if you teach me how. And she was just like, and we're not the same personality type at all. I mean, she drove me a little crazy, if I'm honest, but I said, this is who I want to hire, you know, and management and vice presidents and coworkers were like, she doesn't know anything about motorcycles. You know, we could hire a mechanic and teach them how to use computers, but you know, this, and I was like, you guys got it backwards. You guys have it so backwards. If we hire someone that is teachable, that is trainable, that has a positive attitude and knows how to use the equipment and the software, we can teach them about motorcycles, right? Yeah. Like, you guys have it backwards. If we immerse them in a motorcycle centric environment, they're going to pick that up.
Yes.
And sure enough, she is. I still work with her to this day, even though I don't work with Suzuki. She loves Suzuki. I love Suzuki. But to this day, I call on her for certain tasks because she has this rare ability. I can speak to her and she can make it visual.
Yeah.
And I don't know how people do that because I'm graphically illiterate. But but it's one of those. And she's gone out on her own and done amazing things.
Nice.
Since. And I think we've rubbed off on each other in that way. You know, she kind of got that. She got that self-help chutzpah from me. Yeah. And, you know, and I got that kind of, we can interpret things differently from her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Give me a success story. I'm going to put you on the spot. Okay. Give me someone that came to you with like a side hustle idea. And initially you thought, oh boy, this guy's off the mark. And then it surprised you. Do you have one of those?
Let's
Without
see.
Mentioning their name or putting them on the spot or getting sued.
No. Oh, what's flooding my mind is so many of the guests that I've had on. Like, there's one side hustle that, like, I absolutely love the self-storage business. It's a great business model for so many reasons. However, to get involved in it today, it's quite capital intensive, you know, when you're talking land and buildings. But one side hustle that really flies under the radar because it's not sexy, people don't notice it, but it's picking up trash at industrial buildings, commercial buildings, early in the morning before they open. And the guest that I had on, he was doing that as a side hustle. He got it to low six figures. Like, he just broke the 100,000 doing it himself and then started to branch out and spending time getting contracts and getting other people to do it.
Yeah.
And now he's grossing like 600,000. Picking up trash. It's brilliant. But one of the things that he did was which I think garnered a lot of praise from his clients, is when he was doing that in the mornings and he saw something that needed the property manager owner's attention, he'd shoot a couple of photos, text them, send them a little note. So then that person coming into work knew what they had to deal with.
Yeah.
Said, you know, when I had the storage facility, that would have been so invaluable for me because my place was about 20 minutes outside of town. And if I'd gotten that text from him early in the morning, I don't know, a broken window or a mattress left out or something. It's like, oh, okay, I can stop by the hardware store, grab what I need, get out there, deal with it, et cetera.
Yeah.
And as far as, you know, getting other people to fulfill the contracts that he got, I'm thinking that that would be a great opportunity for retired folks that like to get up early, go for a walk. They get paid for going for a walk. And what are your startup costs? $100?
That's such a good one. That's a really good one.
Another one, I'll just throw another one out there, is the farmer's markets. To have a product, well, I was going to say product or service, but it's going to, you know, 99% of them are going to be products. And one episode that I have not yet released yet is on popcorn. But think about it. What your cost of product is,
yep,
versus selling it for $6 a bag.
Yeah.
Don't get me started on what they charge in movie theaters. But and with something like a farmer's market, you're not signing a long-term lease where you've got that big commitment.
Yeah, it's week over week or month over month maybe, but not long-term.
Yeah, you've got the ability to test your product, hone your sales skill, find out what people are looking for, connect with potential customers. Yeah.
And build yourself a decent profit and loss sheet and then end up on the Shark Tank.
Yes. There you go. So I had an episode just a couple of weeks ago, Melissa Mills, she's got a company called Spread'em. It started in the farmer's market. And she started the company with $500 and a bicycle. She could not afford a car. She was delivering on bicycle. And she makes cashew dips. Now she grew that company where they're doing $3 million in sales per year, and they've got a 20,000 square foot facility. Completely self-funded, they've never borrowed money. It's all been like internal growth, like more people asking, okay, we got to up production. They started it at the home, then they moved into what's known as a commissary kitchen, where you just kind of rent a commercial kitchen. Yeah. And she said, you know, we were making $1 million before we got out of that commissary kitchen. She was so frugal on where she was spending the money. And she said, that's where a lot of people make mistakes, is they get funding or they get money in and, you know, they buy it, that you know, the best stuff are all brand new, and you don't need to do that.
No.
Bootstrap, do it as cheap as you can. She said, I never, ever, ever compromised on the ingredients, but when it came to like the boxes, she said, I always used boxes. I never bought new ones. That came like years later.
Yeah.
You know, oh, so my point with the going and looping back around the markets, to this day, they still do the farmer's markets. For that
really?
Customer contact. Yep. For the feedback. And that's how I actually met her and ended up having her on the show.
Well, the cost of customer acquisition is really low in that environment. Yeah. And the direct feedback is immediate.
Yeah. And they're in like Whole Foods. They're in Safeway. Yeah. So yeah. And they're still at the farmer's market. Yeah.
But the customer feedback through Whole Foods and through Safeway and all that is non-existent, right? Unless someone actually files a, you know, some web form SurveyMonkey or something.
Right.
And then you're only getting the people that really aren't happy. They got an axe to grind. You want to get the positive stuff too. And so, yeah, I could see where the farmer's market would be a really good win-win there.
Mm-hmm.
That's really an awesome story. Yeah. When I launched Mañana No Más, I launched it at the South Valley Economic Development Center in Albuquerque.
Okay.
So this is where they incubated a bunch of startups and new businesses. But the hub of where that was a commercial kitchen. And so salsa companies and coffee companies and sandwich companies and catering companies and all of this stuff would come in. That's where I got my biggest boost of business. Because every time a company came in to start up, the Economic Development Center would say, do you have a website yet? Well, we've got a guy in our offices and he makes websites for startups.
Ah, that was you. Okay.
That's how I got a really good head start. And so, you know, kind of how you're talking about commissary kitchens and all of that, like I can't emphasize enough. Everyone thinks, oh, I need $100,000 to get started. I need $300,000 to get started. And you just told a story about a girl on a bicycle. Like those are the stories to me that just really ramp up. You know, I do a lot of work in software and, you know, WordPress and plugins and stuff. Rob Walling has Startups for the Rest of Us, which is his podcast.
Okay.
And he does, I think it's called MicroConf, where they put small businesses together, but it's all about bootstrapping. It's like, we can invest in companies, but you know, you don't have to take money. You don't have to take an investment. You can bootstrap.
Yep.
And I love talking about companies that that buckled down, put their nose to the grindstone, and got a result. That's cool.
Works. He started a company called Super Jam, but he actually started it with his grandmother's recipe for jam when he was 14 years old, selling jam door to door. Anyway, fast forward to age 16. This is he's out of Edinburgh, Scotland, and he realizes that he's got to ramp up production if he's going to be doing this full time, and he can't be doing it in the kitchen anymore. His mom and dad said they couldn't even get in to cook dinner anymore. I mean, there was jam and jars everywhere. But to get into a factory, I mean, that's big bucks. And at this point, he's 16 years old. He can't get a loan. The parents can't fund it. And most people at that point would say, well, I can't because I don't have the money.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that stops a lot of people. But getting cash in hand is only one way. And if we say, I don't have the money, I can't do it, then we're dead in the water. But he focused on, okay, there's all these reasons why I can't. But you know what, Kurt, there's always ways on how we can. And that's how he focused. And he literally went door to door, on the phone, email, all these different factories, trying to get somebody to upfront the costs, basically to buy into his dream.
Yeah.
All through the UK, Scotland. All of them said no, except one. But that's all he needed.
Yeah, just takes and one.
Because it was like, I think it was around 50,000, 60,000, something like that, when you consider the jars and the product and all that sort of stuff, to get in there. And then got into Waitrose. It's a big deal over there. They have a royal warrant to supply the queen and all that out there. And anyway, there's so many things that he did and so many roadblocks that they told him no, but he figured out a way around it.
Well, some of the best stories are the not accepting the no. Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah. You know, that you go all the way back to Edison for, you know, the famous story about how long it took to make a light bulb, right. But it's so easy to say, I can't do that. When I was in third grade, and I've said this on multiple shows, so bear with me, audience, if you've heard this before, but friends would ask me, what do you want to do when you grow up? Like, what's one thing you want to do when you grow up? And teachers would ask, what's one thing you want to do when you grow up? And I always say, I want to write a book. And everybody just laughed right in my face. And they were like, you don't even like English, dude. Like, what makes you think you're going to write a book? You don't even like English class. And I could never make the correlation in my own mind. Why do people think being good in English class means I can or can't write a book? Like, right. I never understood that. Right. And I was like, I don't.
Good.
I don't
know good. Where, I'm glad.
I don't know why people are doing this to me. But I grew up, like, went through my teens and my 20s thinking, well, I'm never going to be able to write a book because I didn't go to college for English class. And then I finally couldn't sleep at night. I just couldn't with the ideas I had. And I wrote my first book and published my first book in 2007. I didn't think anybody was going to buy it. And that's the book that got me the job at Ducati.
Wow.
That's the book that got me the job at Suzuki. You know, that's the book that got me the, hey, you didn't go to college, but you're still a professional. You know, and now I've got a book on leadership that's out that people are reading. And it's kind of weird. It's almost a surreal experience because now I'm in my 50s and I'm thinking to myself, if I would have bypassed that no 10, 15, 20 years earlier, what would that have been? And I don't beat myself up with regret. Instead, I think, how can I inspire other people to take that action? How do I take that personal loss and go, hey, learn from me, you know, don't settle. If you think you can do something, go do it.
Right.
Just go do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you inspire people past the nose?
Yes. Just something else that you hit on, I think that it's just not think, I know it's vitally important, is you were talking about all these people saying you couldn't do it. The people that we find ourselves surrounded by, and Kurt, I know that you know this, are so important to our lives and where we're going than was built right into our genes at birth. In other words, your environment is more important than your heredity,
yeah,
your upbringing. And so get in the right environment. And when we decide that we want to change our results in a significant way, the people around us aren't used to that. And too often they'll try to pull you back to where they are, because as you go out and start achieving and doing stuff and trying, you're making them look bad in their eyes, you know?
Yeah.
And then when you do not get the result that you're looking for the first time out, I hesitate to use the word failure. It's like we have successes and then we have our learning experiences. Well, when, as we have those learning experiences, they're saying, see, I told you, you know, you should have just stayed back here in your comfort zone rather than go out and try to write the book.
The I told you so is hard to swallow sometimes, but you know, I'm a big fan of John Maxwell, and John Maxwell's book, Failing Forward, is all like, embrace the failure, learn from it, move forward, go, you know, tweak it the next time. The other thing that I learned, and I learned this the hard way, because I chose to learn everything the hard way, John, was there were so many things that I had in my arsenal that would have been winners, but I shut them down early. Like I found that I was early to market on three or four different ventures that I tried. Yes. And when they failed after 2 years or failed on the third year, and other people that I love that love me back were like, dude, it's time to cut the cord on this, man. It's just not working. And then 2-3 years later, someone else does the exact same thing and it becomes a, you know, unbolstered success. And I'm like, wait a minute. I was doing that 5 years ago. That's, I think, I almost think you have to learn that one the hard way to really have it set in. Mm-hmm. But now I have projects that on the surface don't look like they're doing so good. But I'm like, I don't turn them off. Now I'm like, I'm not going to turn it off. I might just be ahead of market.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Like before. And I can't tell you the number of guests I've had on the last year that have talked about that, some aspect of that. I remember one guy, he said, you know, of all the things I tried, if I had just stuck with one of them, any one of them probably would have worked out.
Yeah.
It's that, and I'm not saying this was the case with you, but that shiny object syndrome, you know, you're trying something, you work at, it's not quite working out. And then it's like, oh, what's that over there? Let's go do that. And you were like one step away, 1 6-month period or year away from it turning around. So you got to give it enough time. I had on a top seller. She's like 0.0005% of Amazon sellers. And she's like, it's years. You got to work on a particular SKU, on a particular product to hone it. Like, don't expect you're going to put it up there in like 6 months, you're going to be on your sailboat.
Yeah. You know, there's marketing out there in my personal space for online courses. And that marketing is, you know, the biggest demand right now is online learning. You know, put out your course today and I'll show you how to make 6 figures in the next 3 months and all these things. And I watch that and I think to myself, as someone that is a developer in WordPress that works in this area, I'm like, what a crime to tell people that. it's like the percentage of success, you know, at that level is so low. You need to be like, this is how you get your first 10 paid clients.
Yeah.
You know, the consulting, the training, that those pathways, it's like, this is how you get started. This is how you take action. This is how you get your first 10. This is how you grow that first 10 into the first 25, you know, let's break the first 100 and then go. But it's to get people to, and I asked earlier, like, how do you get people to take action? So I want to go back to that.
Yes. Okay.
Yep. It's how do you get them to take the action? And then how do you get them not to give up too early?
For myself with the podcast, because, and again, you're probably familiar with this, it's only a few podcasts percentage-wise that actually succeed. Most pack it in with 7 or 8 episodes.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a resource, the podcastguests.com, where podcasters list their podcast, wanting guests. And they will only accept you if you've done 10 episodes, because they know that the drop-off rate is underneath that.
Yeah.
And so when I started out in this little venture, not knowing anything about podcasts, I committed that I was going to do it for a year. Absolutely, come hell or high water, I was going to do it for a year, 52 episodes. And then I would give myself the opportunity to reevaluate. Okay, how's it going? Do I want to pursue it, et cetera? And I'm thrilled to say I'm in year 2.
Well, there you go. Congratulations.
But if I had not set that commitment of doing it for a year, I might have bailed.
And I can see where that. So after 4 years of podcasting, and you are interview 95.
Okay.
So
congratulations. That's awesome.
After 4 years, I almost turned it off because I wasn't seeing the numbers, the growth, the influence that I thought that a podcast would bring. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to turn this off. And then Spotify hit me with, your listenership is up 300% and you're in the top 15% of your category. And I was like, woo-hoo! Wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And then when I went to WordCamp in Maryland this year, WordCamp US, complete strangers came up and said, I've been listening to you for 3 years.
Oh man.
You know, aren't you the Mañana No Mas guy? And I was like, I am, but that's weird because people don't call me that. And then they would say, you know, I've been listening to you for 3 years. And I'm flattered, but I'm also angry because I'm like, if you've been listening for 3 years and you haven't liked, shared, commented, posted, sent an email, nothing. It's like, how do I know you're there?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. That is so cool. You wanted to get back to the take action piece.
Yeah, I'm really big. Well, you know, my book is all about action leadership and how to take action. So I'm curious, when you talk to somebody about a side hustle and they're hesitant or they've been talking for years and haven't done it yet. I run into that a lot.
Okay.
What's the catalyst? What's the catapult for you to work with somebody and go, you just need to do this?
Let me comment as to why they feel that way in the first place, and then what to do about it.
Okay.
So I'm going to go back in time. I'm in my early 20s, living in Toronto, had hardly traveled, but heard of the Golden Buddha that's housed in Bangkok, Thailand. It's incredible. And when I heard about it, I thought, I got to see this thing in person. Some way, somehow, I don't know. But I wrote it down as a goal. And when we make out our list of goals, don't give any thought as to how you're going to pull it off. You're not there yet. Just write down what you want. So for me, this was kind of a, what I would call like a priority C goal. It's not something that I wanted this red hot minute, but it's something I thought this would be so cool when I do see it. A few years go by and I'm invited to work with Malaysian Airlines over in Malaysia, doing some seminars. And one of the people in the audience is from Bangkok. And she offers for me to come visit her on my way back to Canada, which I did. So now I'm standing in front of this statue in Bangkok. It's about 10 feet tall, 3 meters. It is pure gold. It's thought to be about 8 centuries old, and it's valued at about $250 million. The thing that intrigued me is the backstory. Long, long time ago, under the threat of invasion by Burmese soldiers, the keepers of the statue were concerned about its safety. Well, they couldn't exactly pick it up and move it. This thing is like 5 tons. So they came up with a brilliant solution. They decided to hide it in plain view. They covered it in layers of plaster, then painted it, then inlaid bits of colored glass so that it looked attractive, but not necessarily worth anything. Well, it worked, but the disguise worked so well that over the years, over the decades, over the generations, in fact, the mystery of what lay underneath that plaster, the beauty and the value, remained hidden until, get this, 1957. It was being moved from one location to the other in Bangkok. The workers put these straps around it, lifted it by the crane, and when they went to move it, one of the straps broke, chips the corner of the statue, and they could see the gold underneath. Now, standing looking at this thing, I'm thinking, how could something so stunning, so valuable, so commanding be hidden for so long? I think you see where I'm going here with this. That same sense of awe can and should be felt for what lies at the core of you and I, because you and I, like that storied Buddha, were born golden, but almost immediately we begin to be covered up in these layers of negative conditioning and self-doubt and self-talk and that negative input from others. And you know, Kurt, for a lot of adults over the years, those layers aren't chipped away. They're added upon. And that a possibility within them just, you know, diminishes those goals, those dreams, that sense of I can do this. And so how can you bust through that? And to be honest with you, it's been most of my adult life work is figuring out ways to do that and helping people do that through the seminars, through the book, et cetera. Yeah. And one of the most powerful ways, and it goes back to talking about that light bulb moment for people, is to get them talking about something that excites them, that they'd really like to have, do, or be. And if you can get them talking about it and focused on it long enough, they begin to get that seed of possibility that, you know, maybe I can. But because those layers have been on there for so long and for so many years, one conversation isn't going to do it. And that's why we need to have these conversations and these education on an ongoing basis, why a lot of us, and I'm sure you're in that camp as well, the personal development piece isn't something that you do once and it's like, okay, I've done that. You know, reading the book is fine, but then you've got to implement it. So something, you know, a little bit every day, whether that's a bit of a video or a book or something. And there's so many online resources that don't cost you anything anymore. So, you know, like put down the phone or what you're scrolling on and really tune into something that's going to really feed your mind. So what's going to pull you out of that uncomfortableness is going after something that makes it worthwhile. So not a goal that somebody thinks you should do, that your, you know, your parents or your spouse or society thinks that you should do, but something that you really want to do, like writing that first book. I don't care if the rest of the world tells you you can't do it. It's got to be something that get you excited about. And the thing is to continue that process of self-development, because those beliefs that you hold about yourself, I can't do this, I can't do that, they've been your traveling companion for a long, long time. And so to reverse that, you're basically inputting new information, new beliefs, and that takes spaced time repetition. We learn basically two ways. One is through impact, when something really impactful happens and boom, we change.
Yeah.
And then there's repetition, hearing something over and over and over again until it really sinks in. And so when you hear these success stories of people, like we might not have to, I won't go into detail, but Tim Harris, a young man who opened up a restaurant that I write about in my book, no one with his medical condition had ever been a restaurateur. He has Down syndrome, but he kept talking about it since he was 14 years old. And his parents finally said, this kid's serious. Like maybe we should support him.
And is this the kid in New Mexico?
Yeah.
So I'm friends. Friends with his family from church.
No way.
Yeah, I totally know the guy. He gives everybody a hug when they go to the restaurant.
It's breakfast, yeah. Lunch, and hugs.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I interviewed the parents too, because I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, Tim with Down syndrome has challenges that I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
But there are some attributes that he has. Keith, I think was his father's name. I said to Keith, man, you need to write a book like Lessons from Tim. And he's like, yeah, we are. So one quick Tim story. He's also involved in addition to having that restaurant where, yes, they serve breakfast, lunch, and hugs. So they've got, for your listeners, Tim has a hug counter that is displayed. And so he's got a little, you know, those hand counters. Every time he gives somebody a hug, he records it there, and then they change up to the board. And I think when I interviewed him, he had like 80,000 hugs or something like that. In addition to the restaurant, he's also a very accomplished Paralympian, mm-hmm. and has won a number of medals. And at one point, this was at President Obama's, one of his terms, invited a lot of the Paralympians to the White House to celebrate this luncheon. Well, the invitation came, and Keith and Jeannie, I believe is her name, got the invitation for Tim and them to go to the White House for this luncheon. They were so excited. So they go down to the restaurant to meet Tim. And immediately Tim's like, oh, I didn't get to hug the president. and the parents are like, Tim, you just can't run up to the president of the United States and give him a hug, you know, like their Secret Service and their security. But you know, Tim just locks into an idea and it's like, I don't know how I'm gonna do it, but I'm gonna do it. So anyway, so they're at the luncheon. There's 100 people in the room. President Obama's at the front. He's got these little cue cards with little notes on it for all the Paralympics attendees. And he gets to Tim. And President Obama says, hey, Tim, it says here that you have a restaurant and you serve breakfast, lunch, and hugs. I didn't get a hug. What's up with that, man? Tim didn't miss a beat. He jumped out of his chair, ran up to the stage, gives Obama a big hug. And says, I love you, Obama. And Obama says, I love you back, Tim. It was, quote, the hug scene around the world. It was in 31 international newspapers. And when I'm sharing that story from the stage, the next slide that I show is a picture of Tim on stage hugging Michelle Obama. That was about a year and a half earlier, or excuse me, later for another event. So
yeah.
just that story alone, like I'm thinking that if somebody wants to open up a restaurant, because I mean, there is a big failure rate, and they see that and they think, oh, I can't do it. And then they read that story and they think, oh man, if Tim can do it, like I need to get my act together and start. And I mean, you don't have to open the restaurant tomorrow. You don't have to start the side hustle tomorrow, but there is something that you know that you could move the needle forward a little bit right now.
Some kind of action, something.
Yeah. You know, like if you've got a big goal, you're not going to know all the steps to it, because then it's really not a big goal. It's more like you're writing down a to-do list. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you've never owned a restaurant before and that's what you want to do, it's like, I don't know how I'm going to pull that off. Well, where do I start?
And for each person, it's a different starting point, but there's got to be that forward momentum. There's got to be, you know, 21 irrefutable laws of leadership. Momentum's one of them. You know, you've got to get something going.
Yes. I interviewed someone that has a string of very successful cookbooks. And at one point she wanted to do bottled sauces out of one of the recipes because people were asking them for her. And she didn't have a clue how to do that. That was her first step, was Googling, how do I bottle sauces? You know, you start.
Joan, I could talk, you and I have a dangerous feeling that you and I could probably get in a room together and just bother everybody else because we'd never shut up.
I think so.
I thank you so much for coming to the show, and I want to value your time. If our readers or listeners want to get, because this will be on the blog post as well. So if our readers or listeners are like, man, I got to get in touch with Joan, I got to figure out how I take the next step, what does that look like? What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Probably the best way is sidehustlehero.com.
Nice. And then just to give someone further inspiration, what's like the perfect example of someone getting in touch with you that has a dream or a goal? Like a side hustle thing.
Like the makeup of them or?
Yeah. Yeah. What's the best position someone could be in to get in touch with Joan?
Like the reason behind it?
Yeah.
Reason behind it, that they know that there's something bigger out there for them. They either don't know what it is, or they do know what it is and they don't know how to take the first step, or they're scared to do so.
I love that. I knew you'd come through with an awesome answer on that one. Folks, that is a wrap. This is Joan Posavi. I really encourage you to reach out to her. All of the contact links are going to be in the show notes. And with that, Joan, let's say goodbye to the folks.
Thank you so much, Kurt. Thanks, everyone.